President Bush is taking last night's State of the Union speech on the road. This morning at a DuPont research facility in Delaware, he touted his proposal to cut gas consumption by 20% in 10 years through more use of alternative fuels and tougher gas mileage standards for cars.
I made the case last night to the American people that we have got to do something about our dependence on oil for two reasons. One, dependence on oil provides an economic and national security risk, a problem that this country better start dealing with in a serious fashion now before it becomes acute. And second, we've got to be wise stewards of the environment, and dependency on oil makes it harder to be wise stewards of the environment.
The president will highlight other policy ideas in the days to come, including his proposal to make health insurance tax deductible by up to $15,000 per family. Critics are already saying that will tax the middle class but not help the poor. But the war in Iraq dominated last night's speech, and today Democrats and Republicans in the Senate are hunkered down, drafting an increasingly popular resolution saying that the president's proposed increase in troops is, quote, not in the national interest. Well, joining us on the line first from Washington, Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And Gail, first of all, what is the day after talk in Washington about the speech in general?
I think both sides of the aisle were struck by the fact that the president was very careful in the subjects that he brought up. No talk about manned missions to Mars, no axis of evil. He picked subjects about which there was already considerable bipartisan agreement.
Some would say he actually picked some that are largely Democratic issues.
Another way to say the same point, exactly. The question, though, is where does it go from here? Democrats clearly feel, on issues like global warming, that they are already out in front of the president, that they have been there for years. They're not inclined to give him much credit going forward, but they do need him to work with them. They want to make sure that proposals aren't vetoed, and they also want a record of accomplishment. It's something that both the president and the Democrats that now control the House and the Senate share. They both want something out of the next 2 years. That, I think, gives some momentum to their collaboration.
Well, we're going to have presidential scholar Julian Zelitzer in just a moment with more on, you know, the president's performance, if you will. But to the work that's going on today in Washington, Democrat Joseph Biden said today that the resolution that his Senate committee is drafting is not an attempt to embarrass the president, an attempt to save the president from making a significant mistake with regard to our policy in Iraq. So it feels as if last night's, it really was a plea for people to join him in his plan, fell on deaf ears. Or are you hearing of anyone, Republican or Democrat, who was won over last night?
No, I think if anything, last night, and even more important than last night, I would say, was General Petraeus's appearance before the Senate Armed Forces Committee. This is one of the most effective field officers we have right now. He's respected by both sides of the aisle. And he made a very quiet appeal to basically give him a chance. You know, give this a chance. And I think that in terms of how members of Congress are reacting today, it has as much to do with what the general said as with what the president said.
Meaning what? Because it doesn't sound as if they are. We're hearing, for instance, Senator Chuck Hagel of Nebraska. He's the only Republican on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and he said today, he's the only Republican on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee to announce his support for the resolution.
Right.
And he said today, there's no strategy. You know, this is a ping pong game with American lives. Pretty damning.
No, he is absolutely eloquent. He said today, how are we helping the American military by remaining silent? But the key, and this debate is still going on, I just left it to talk to you, but one of the key voices that I was waiting to hear was Senator Lugar, who basically made an appeal to Republicans that I think is going to carry a lot of weight. He said that the president has already said he's going to ignore the resolution. The president hasn't listened to us. We're all very frustrated about that. But don't, he said, let your frustration take you in a place that's going to hurt the country. What this resolution would do is further isolate a president who has the authority to do what he's doing. Even Senator Biden isn't talking yet about the only thing that really would make a difference, which is pulling funding. Since we're not doing that, the president's going to do it anyway. Lugar said, keep open the channels of communication. We can influence this outcome, but not if we set up this harsh divide, you know, just the day after. the State of the Union. I'm expecting that'll carry a lot of Republican weight and might even break block a stampede over to the Democratic side. The frustration among Republicans is acute right now. It's very difficult, publicly or privately, to find anyone who wholeheartedly supports what this White House is doing. They made a lot of mistakes and cost the Republicans their majority. But I suspect that Senator Lugar is going to pull some of the wavering ones with him today, which brings us to the next discussion, which will be with Senator Warner on the Armed Services Committee, who's also crafting a bipartisan resolution.
Well, before we let you go, we just want to say that Republicans have been saying that Democrats don't have a clear plan, but it seemed that Democratic Senator Jim Webb very succinctly sketched one out in his response to the speech last night. He said, we need more diplomacy, not a precipitous withdrawal, but in short order, get our combat forces out of Iraq, and in the meantime, take our soldiers off the streets of Iraq City. He just boom, boom, boom.
A star was born last night.
Is that your sense?
This is a remarkable talent on the Senate side. Take a look also at what he said on the domestic side. He made the case that John Edwards has been making, but I would say far more eloquently, about the two different countries we're in. He said, when I graduated from college, the average CEO salary was about 20 times the average worker. Now it's 400 times. He said, Teddy Roosevelt put a stop to this yawning class divide, and that's what the next president has to do as well. Current president has to do as well.
Well, Gail Chadwick, speaking of next president, when you say a star is born, Jim Webb is freshman, but he's a former assistant secretary of the Navy under Reagan, comes from a long military family. He himself served in Vietnam. His son is in combat in Iraq. Do you see suddenly a new presidential candidate?
I do, except for one thing. I have never seen a national candidate who so dislikes campaigning. I once was covering one of his events, and I had a desperate family commitment, and I said to my husband, just let me go to this. I'll be the first one out the door. And I was, but I was lapped by Jim Webb, who was the headliner, who beat me out the door. This is not what you do when you really aspire to win elections. Hmm. But I think his talent may more than make up for his very strong aversion to the campaign trail.
Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. We'll let you go back to those Senate hearings. And Gail, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Well, we turn out a Boston University professor of American history, Julian Zeltzer, and a presidential scholar at that. And Julian, we do want to talk more about Senator Webb and your thoughts on his presidential possibilities. But first, last night, let's start with some sound from the speech. An historic moment for any president, certainly one last night for Mr. Bush, acknowledging the first female Speaker of the House.
Thank you very much. And tonight I have the high privilege and distinct honor of my own as the first president to begin the State of the Union message with these words, Madam Speaker.
Gracious moment, Julian. But overall, what did you see in Bush? How did you see him last night?
I saw a president who's embattled and whose presidency is imperiled, and he is trying everything to maintain credibility and to maintain support, not among Democrats, but among Republicans. And it wasn't a dramatic speech. It was a relatively normal speech, which is the best he could do at this point.
Well, there was no fire, no axis of evil. In fact, as we were saying, hardly any of the Republican agenda. What struck you about the domestic agenda the president outlined?
The first thing was what he didn't say. I mean, he didn't bring up any of the measures that the Democratic House has already passed in the first 100 days, which struck me as a little surprising. That was the obvious area to reach out to Democrats. Bring me the minimum wage, I'll sign it. He didn't do that. He held off. And then he put forth a national health insurance bill, which I think is going to be quite controversial. It's already been declared dead on arrival by a prominent member of the Ways and Means Committee. And then he had a very bold and somewhat vague energy program, which sounds good, but I think the devil in the details will be pretty devastating when this hits Capitol Hill. So I think he had some ideas, some areas of consensus in principle, but I didn't see many proposals that are going to really get out of this gridlock that we're probably going to face.
Well, early on, he spoke about, finding the country with a divided government and disagreement about major issues. Let's listen.
We're not the first to come here with a government divided and uncertain in the air. Like many before us, we can work through our differences, and we can achieve big things for the American people. Our citizens don't much care which side of the aisle we sit on, as long as we're willing to cross that aisle when there's work to be done.
Julian, you know, reach into history for us, maybe recent history. You know, when else has a president had to sort of go, not hat in hand, but confront this divided Congress, especially at a time of war?
Well, President Clinton is the most famous. After losing control of Congress to the Republicans in 1994, both in 95 and 96, he made a series of conciliatory addresses, the second in 96 saying the year of big government is over. And he kind of said, I will work with you. I will work with the Republicans. And he acknowledged my big vision isn't there anymore. And then he was actually quite effective. But this came very early on in his presidency. So he worked toward the center from the beginning, really. Whereas Bush, this is coming very late in his presidency after 6 years of incredible partisanship. And so it's much harder for him to do what Bill Clinton achieved, I think, politically.
We want to talk about other examples. I know you want to mention President Johnson, but it's funny you mentioned that this comes so late because we want to talk about how others viewed the speech last night. You say maybe it wasn't, you know, it doesn't go down in the annals. And I can't remember a phrase from it, but according to CNN, more than three quarters of Americans who watched President Bush's State of the Union address had a positive reaction to it. Let's see, 67% of the speech watchers say that his policies will move the country to the right. Now, that's a little less than, you know, the positive response he's had in the last few years, but still more than some might think. And we set out to sample a little opinion of our own. I mean, this is certainly not scientific at all, but we had arranged to call the Starliner Diner in Hilliard, Ohio, and arranged to speak to someone there.
Starliner, Georgina.
Well, what'd you think?
It was okay. You know, like they talked about insurance, you know, for the poor and different things. You know, it's hard no matter what president's in there. People is going to disagree, and the Democrats are, you know, in the House now.
The president seemed to plead with the Democrats in Congress to try his plan in Iraq.
Well, I think they should. You know, you just can't pull out right away.
Yeah. Are you having some sympathy for him?
No.
Oh. Are people talking about the speech in the diner?
I just heard them say nothing's changed, you know.
That's Georgina, who runs the front desk at the Starliner Diner there outside Columbus, Ohio. Glenn Dole was there as well. He's one of the regulars. He runs the Curtis Elliott set design firm outside Columbus, and we asked his thoughts.
I guess what I wanted to hear from the president was something about New Orleans and what was happening there. I think that it's a national disgrace.
The Katrina and New Orleans weren't even mentioned.
That's right. I think it's no longer in the American consciousness, and I think that we should have heard something about it.
Yeah.
I think that what I heard from him, if I were going to characterize the whole speech, was too little too late.
That's Glenn Dole at the Starliner Diner in Hilliard, Ohio. Glenn, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
And Juliet Zelitzer, in just the seconds we have, seeming to agree with you, too little too late?
Yeah, and I think that's the best he can do. There's a political situation he faces that's much bigger than any speech can resolve.
Tell you what, we're going to take a break, come back with more from Julian Zelitzer and more from those polls. Some people disagree. Much more coming up here and now. We're speaking with historian Julian Zelitzer of Boston University about the State of the Union speech last night. And we're also going to be speaking about James Webb's rebuttal to the president. We'll have a little more on that in a second. But, Julian, you were talking about, you know, times in history that you can reach back and compare to what we're living through right now. Give us another one.
Lyndon Johnson's State of the Union in 1967 tried to take attention away from Vietnam. Most of what he talked about was his domestic achievements. And he laid out a big laundry list. And at the end, he came to Vietnam. But unfortunately for Johnson, you know, after a few months, it was Vietnam everyone was still talking about. A war hits a certain tipping point. It's hard to get out of the public mind. I think that's where we are again today.
And the president did speak about it, of course. Quite a different tone than in the past. Almost, you know, please give war a chance, if you will. Let's listen.
We went into this largely united in our assumptions and in our convictions. And whatever you voted for, you did not vote for failure. Our country is pursuing a new strategy in Iraq, and I ask you to give it a chance to work. And I ask you to support our troops in the field and those on their way.
Julian, I heard an analyst today on CNN say President Bush's, or his aides have said to this reporter I heard on CNN, that are saying that President Bush is trying to be to terrorism what Ronald Reagan was to communism, meaning that Ronald Reagan's policies were attacked by liberals in his time, but eventually everyone recognized that they defeated communism. Now, that was the take of the White House. Your thoughts?
Look, I think there's a lot of controversy over that. Many people say the communism ended and Reagan happened to be in the right place at the right time.
That it fell of its own weight.
Yeah, and it was in the final 2 years he benefited from that. But it wasn't anything he did with his policies. And if that's the case for President Bush, he needs to depend on something dramatic happening to the terrorist networks that, you know, constitute the threat. And there's no evidence that's going on right now. Very different.
And, well, and also, it reminds me, too, speaking of Reagan, when he did finally reach a deal with Gorbachev, he was attacked from his base for being too liberal. And, you wonder if Bush faces the same future, if he's going to make the same parallel, that he might have to make friends to make peace.
Yeah, when Ronald Reagan took those steps, he was enormously unpopular. We forget this in the final 2 years from the right wing. They said he was, you know, being fooled by the Soviets. And right now, Bush would have to make that same kind of move, but with the war going terribly. We have a hot war. We didn't have that in the late 1980s. So it's a very different situation and much harder for Bush to distance himself right now from his base.
Well, Julian, we want to make sure that you weigh in on the Democratic response. We just heard Gail Chadwick say Washington, and she's saying a star was born last night. This, again, to remind us, is the Republican-turned-Democrat, former Vietnam veteran, his son in combat in Iraq. Mm-hmm. He held a picture of his father, who was in combat in North Korea. He said he slept with it when he was a kid. Let's listen to what he said. He really worked an historical angle, and he spoke of Andrew Jackson, saying that Jackson said a country's economic success should be measured not at its apex but at its base, and he wants Bush to do that. And he also brought in Teddy Roosevelt and Eisenhower. Let's listen.
Regarding the economic imbalance in our country, I'm reminded of the situation President Theodore Roosevelt faced in the early days of the 20th century. America was then, as now, drifting apart along class lines. The so-called robber barons were unapologetically raking in a huge percentage of the national wealth. The dispossessed workers at the bottom were threatening revolt. Roosevelt spoke strongly against these divisions. He told his fellow Republicans that they must set themselves, quote, as resolutely against improper corporate influence on the one hand as against demagogy and mob rule on the other. And he did something about it. As I look at Iraq, I recall the words of former general and soon-to-be president Dwight Eisenhower during the dark days of the Korean War, which had fallen to a bloody stalemate. When comes the end? Asked the general who had commanded our forces in Europe during World War II. And as soon as he became president, he brought the Korean War to an end.
Julian Zelitzer, first of all, did Jim Webb get his history right?
Yeah, no, he gave a very nice history lesson, both about the economy and about war. And I think he was quite accurate using the history to tie into Democratic themes today.
Your thoughts on him last night?
I was very impressed on two levels. First, the delivery was very appealing, a very straightforward kind of person that we don't see in politics.
Apparently he tore his speech up and wrote it again.
That's very believable. And I think the two themes, he did what many Democrats have been stumbling over in the last 6 years. He gave two clear issues that Democrats could run on. A, how to get out of Iraq, and B, an issue that's been under the radar but was central in 2006 in the elections, this economic populism, a way to deal not just with poverty, but economic inequality for working and middle-class Americans. And I think many of the so-called moderates in the Democratic Party, like Webb, are willing to vote with their party on big issues that I think could be very appealing to Democrats.
Well, and we should say, Gail is thinking that, except for the fact that he hates to campaign, this might be yet another hat in the Democratic ring, which is turning into sort of a hat room with so many people now announcing for 2008. But to be reminded, he is very conservative on social issues.
Yeah, he's conservative on social issues, liberal, it seems, at least, on economic issues. And on military issues, he's a hawk who's against this war, and he's against expansive involvement in certain operations. So he might be the kind of eclectic mix that is going to be very good for Democrats, maybe not this coming election even, maybe the following. But I think he's a serious person in the political arena.
Yeah. And Julian, one last question. We're talking about the State of the Union. I'm sure some people are saying, what I watched, and I can't even think of what's on, at any other time, but is it something that fades from view, or have there been State of the Unions that really have changed the course of history?
Sure, there have been historic ones when Franklin Roosevelt laid out various ideas like the Four Freedoms that continue to resonate in the public mind. Most State of the Unions, no. They're not things we remember. We don't know, years what they were about. And ultimately, they're more political. It's more about the posturing and what a president's trying to say in terms of what's coming in the next month. And that's what we're looking for. Very rarely do we have one that goes down in the history books.
And you've already said this one probably won't, but we want to say again that according to CNN, 67% of the people who watched it felt that Bush's policies as announced last night might move the country in the right direction. So we'll continue to watch. Julian Zelitzer, Boston University professor of American history and a fan of presidents, if you will. Thank you so much for speaking to us about
Thank you.
And speaking of which, there was another former president, at least in town last night here in Boston, and we'll listen in on what happened when former President Jimmy Carter went to Brandeis University. That's coming up. Much more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from
And now, former President Jimmy Carter spoke to an attentive overflow audience at Boston's Brandeis University last night. It was an appearance that almost didn't happen. After protests, op-ed articles, and angry debate over the contents of President Carter's new book and its title, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid, Harvard professor Alan Dershowitz and others accused Carter of assigning full blame to Israel for the continuing conflict in the Middle East. Here's Carter at Brandeis last night responding to the criticism.
This is the first time that I've ever been called a liar and a bigot and an anti-Semite and a coward and a plagiarist. This has hurt me.
Here now is Monica Brady Meyerhoff, attended the forum last night, and she joins us today with more. Monica, welcome.
Hi, Robin.
And let's remind our listeners, students at Brandeis had asked Carter to speak, right?
That's right. They initiated the invitation, but at first it came with a suggestion that he debate Alan Dershowitz about the book. Later that was retracted and he came alone and was given an hour for his appearance.
Right, because Carter refused the debate, the school re-extended the invitation as a sort of screened question and answer session. Dershowitz was allowed to speak afterwards. So all in all, how'd it go?
Well, he was received with a standing ovation when he arrived. And when he spoke, as you could hear just now, it was absolutely quiet. And that was a gym filled with 1,700 people. So they were very respectful. There were no catcalls or protests inside, even though you knew that there were many differing views. And there were some people there who vehemently disagreed with him. But everyone was respectful. And Carter himself joked that except for his inaugural address about 30 years ago, it was the most exciting invitation he's received.
Well, we understand many of the students wore pins equating Israel with peace. And so obviously there were some who disagreed with him. Well, how, first of all, did former President Carter, who won the Nobel Peace Prize, defend his use of the truly of a rather incendiary word, apartheid?
Well, he says he realized that it's caused great concern to the Jewish community. So he really said he understands that and he's upset by that. But he defended the title vehemently, saying that it makes clear that the book is about conditions and events in the Palestinian territories and not Israel, and that the forced separation he's talking about with apartheid is not based on race but on land acquisition. He also noted that Nelson Mandela had visited the territories and used the word apartheid to describe the situation, and so have prominent Israelis. More than anything else, Carter said he used that word to spark debate about why the peace process has been stalled for 6 years.
I chose that title knowing that it would be provocative. But I think in the long run, it has precipitated at least discussion. There has been a lot of positive discussion. And I believe it has brought the issue of a lack of progress on peace for Israel and a lack of progress on the end of the Palestinian suffering to the forefront.
We understand, Monica, that he also invited Brandeis professors and students to go to the Palestinian territories and see what he was talking about.
Yeah, that was an interesting invitation to say, please take a group there and tell me where I'm wrong. Tell me what really is wrong in this book. See for yourselves.
Well, and some, I understand, were saying last night, what's wrong is saying that Israel should give up land that it acquired in a legitimate war. Tell us more about that aspect.
Yes, in the book and also at the event, the repeating theme is that Israel is responsible for making peace by following the past UN resolutions it agreed to. And over this point, 14 members of the Carter Center Advisory Board resigned recently in protest because they said that the book has made Carter an advocate for one side, the Palestinians. And Carter made this point again, though, last night about Israeli responsibility.
Israel will never find peace until it is willing to withdraw from its neighbor's land and to permit the Palestinians to exercise their basic human and political rights.
Now there, Monica, is President Carter talking about both settlements and the land acquired in the 1967 war.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, Carter, from what we hear, also seemed to revise his tone a little, at least regarding one accusation. He'd been accused of being sympathetic to and justifying suicide bombings. And we understand a student asked him a question about that.
Yes, they did. And he was much more conciliatory. He said that the sentence, in which he appears to condone suicide bombings and terrorist attacks as a means to a political end, was just wrong. He said that he wrote this sentence in a stupid way, is the wording he used, and he's asked his publishers to change it. He also confronted the accusation that he said Jews control the media in the United States. He said he never said that. He doesn't believe it. And he answered a charge that the Carter Center has received millions of dollars from Saudi Arabia, and that's why it's so sympathetic to the Palestinian cause, or that's why he is apparently sympathetic in the book. But he said that he's looked at all the numbers and figures for the center, and that the combined contribution of all Arab nations makes up less than 3% of the center's budget.
Right. Well, as we said, Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz was not allowed into the forum, but gave a rebuttal afterwards. What did he say?
Well, he said that had Carter written the book in the conciliatory tone that he spoke last night, there probably wouldn't be any controversy at all. But that aside, he also said that he believed Carter got a lot of his facts wrong and that he was overly simplistic about the situation. But overall, Dershowitz was pretty incendiary after saying, you know, he respected Carter for his efforts for peace, and they both agree there should be peace with Israel and Palestine, but that he believed that Carter just really oversimplified the situation.
President Carter makes the suggests that everything rides on Israel's decision not to give back land, that somehow this is about land and that small percentage of Israelis who live in the occupied areas and want not to give up land are the only barrier to peace. That simply is not the reality. That is not the world on the ground.
That's Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz speaking last night at Brandeis University, right after former President Jimmy Carter held a forum. And what would you say, Monica? Would you say that people were, you know, maybe swayed from their position after the evening, or maybe more hardened in their stance?
Well, the people I spoke with seem not to have changed their minds. They seem to have come in with a view, either open-minded or in agreement with Carter, to hear his position. And many of those people I spoke to on their way out the door after the president spoke. Then the people that I spoke to who stayed to hear Alan Dershowitz were opposed to many of the things Carter said, thought he was biased and wrong. And therefore, I didn't see that a lot of minds were changed. I saw that there were two opposing views in the room, and half the room left with Carter, and the other half stayed to hear Dershowitz.
Here now is Monica Brady-Meyerhoff on last night's forum at Brandeis University. Monica, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
We have this quick note from the Middle East. Men claiming to be al-Qaeda operatives stormed a resort in Gaza yesterday, blowing up a reception hall. The attack, according to the Associated Press, was meant to intimidate Palestinian President Abbas. Al-Qaeda is not known to have a presence in Gaza or the West Bank, despite claims by Abbas that the group is operating there. Palestinian officials say they will investigate the claim. Still to come, what do you get when you blend Argentinian tango and American jazz? Well, the music of saxophonist Bernardo Monk, and that's still ahead. You're listening to Here and Now. People at the Gallup Organization have been polling citizens from 10 predominantly Muslim nations, representing more than 80% of the Muslim world, to find out their views on religion and democracy. They surveyed more than 10,000 people in Turkey, Egypt, Lebanon, Pakistan, Iran, and other Muslim nations. People rich and poor, rural and urban, young and old, male and female. And Gallup found that people saw no conflict between Islam and democracy. Well, joining us with more of the results is Dalia Mogahed. She's executive director of the Gallup Center for Muslim Studies. And first of all, tell us, am I characterizing this correctly, that Muslims you spoke to didn't see much conflict?
You're right, Robin. They don't. People in the case studies that we examine do say that religion is an important part of their life and even see it as playing a strong role, not only in their personal, but in their public life. At the same time, they say what they admire most about the Western world is democracy and liberty, and would want these same values for themselves.
Liberty, fair judicial systems, freedom of speech, they like those things.
Absolutely.
Well, and so they feel that their faith, Islam, and some of those freedoms that they think democracy presents can go hand in hand. Mm-hmm. But let's remind ourselves, the faith, Islam, often brings with it Sharia law, which is a very harsh law. Were they saying that Sharia law can exist with democracy?
Yes, in fact they did. In all of these countries, with the exception of Turkey, majorities said that Sharia should play either a source or in fact be the only source of legislation.
And what did they mean by that when they said that, for people who may not be familiar with Sharia law?
Linguistically, the word simply means Islamic religious principles as they exist in the Quran and the prophetic tradition. Sometimes it means, though, religious law, actual laws, but there is a great deal of diversity as to what those religious laws are, and a lot of internal debate as to what those religious laws are. So what we find is that while people are saying they want Sharia as a form of legislation or as a source of legislation, they are in the same moment saying they want equal rights for women, freedom of religion, freedom of assembly, and freedom of the press. So this concept of Sharia might be understood very differently by the respondents than it sometimes is portrayed here in the West.
Well, because in the West, it's often understood that the harshest form of Sharia law is associated with, as you write, the stoning of adulterers, chopping off limbs for theft, imprisonment or death. It sounds as if that's not what your respondents are talking about, if they're also talking about democratic freedoms.
You're right. We still have to do more research and really dig into that question. What we do know, though, is that historically Sharia has really meant a much broader concept than just those laws that you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. It really was a set of principles that presented a limit to the tyranny of the Sultan, who could not overstep the laws of Sharia because they were believed to be divinely ordained. And so it might be that a call for Sharia today is, in fact, a call for the rule of law.
Do they feel that religious leaders should play a role in government?
Interestingly, the answer is no. Majorities don't think that religious leaders should play a direct role in government. While they believe that religious leaders could advise legislators, that they themselves should not be put directly in control of legislation. However, at the same time, religious principles should inform legislators as they create law. Yeah.
I just want to ask you before we let you go about Iran. What was your finding? What did people say as opposed to what their reality is? It's an officially an Islamic government with religious leaders in positions of power.
Right.
What did the people say they thought would be a good government?
Well, that's the interesting thing. In Iran, 58% say that they don't think that religious leaders should play any role at all in drafting legislation, which is, of course, very different from reality. So you've got a situation in Iran where the public sentiment is the opposite of what is actually happening in government, as far as the role of religious leaders. And at the same time, you have other places that want more religion than actually exists in their secular governments.
Dalia Mogahed is executive director of the Gallup Center for Muslim Studies, talking about their most recent study about the Muslim world's views on Islam and democracy. Dalia, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Oh, in this note, Dalia also told us that her group was unable to survey Iraqi Muslims because of the security concerns in that country, and they hope to be able to do that down the road. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. ¶¶ now. When you think of the tango, you probably think of the strumming of the guitar, the clapping. Bernardo Monk thinks of the saxophone. Bernardo Monk grew up in a musical family in Buenos Aires. He lived and breathed the atmosphere of the tango, but he was also listening to Charlie Parker. Now he's made his mark fusing the tradition of tango with the improvisational style of jazz. Argentinian composer Osvaldo Golijov says that Monk is the tango musician that Piazzolla was dreaming of and never got to know. Monk's new CD is called Ponele a la Firma, or Take That to the Bank, and he's here in the studio with more. Welcome.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, first of all, remind us about what people do think of when they think of Argentinian tango, said to have originated in the immigrant communities in Buenos Aires.
Well, this music is a fusion of many rhythms. Some of them are the habanera, which is started as the contradanza from Spain, then went to Cuba. They came back to Spain, and in the theater companies it was included, and then that's the way it was inserted in Argentina, through the theater, as well as the tango from Andalusia.
We understand that lyrically, actually some of the early lyrics were kind of obscene, and it was sort of a way for men in brothels to, you know, compete for women.
Yeah, it belonged to lower classes, and, well, it was used everywhere. Arriba, si sos pobre no hay derecho, si son muchas las barrigas que tenés que llenar. Arriba, a laburar 12 horas, pa' que te paguen chirolas, y así poderla cuerpear.
Well, and it's said now that, you know, tango not as openly sexual as it was before, but I'm thinking it must be very sensual for you to perform the music while your wife dances on stage.
Yeah, don't forget there's another partner involved.
Well, that's true.
But yes, it's inspiring. I mean, it's something that that we learn a lot together.
Well, she's got a dance partner, but you've got the saxophone.
Yes, I do, in fact.
So you both have another partner.
Yeah, that's true.
Which did you fall in love with first, the tango sound, the Argentinian sound with the possibility of saxophone or saxophone? And then maybe I'll work it into tango.
Well, if you are born in Buenos Aires, you don't have many options but to absorb that music.
Yeah.
So it was both things at a time. I liked singing the traditional pieces. And in the meantime, I started playing the saxophone because everybody in my family are musicians.
Who else inspired you to pick up the saxophone besides Charlie Parker?
Paquito de Rivera. And then there's this great album by Sting. That album is called Bring on the Night, and Branford Marsalis is playing there, and I just got shocked when I heard that. It was always a mystery, that instrument, for me.
And the piece that we're listening to is a song called Paika Papusa, have I?
Yes.
And I understand this was written for your wife, who's a dancer, and you incorporate that sort of improvisational jazz with that dance music. Tell us about that.
No matter how innovator you want to be, this is a dancing music. This tune is specifically another rhythm. It's a tango rhythm called milonga.
I guess that sort of wrestles with what tango is. Tango's very much as the dance is, so precise, one false move and a very pointy shoe, you know, could go in the wrong place. It's very, very precise, and the music seems to be very orderly. So there's a tension there between your improv and the form.
Well, you want to be careful, and the fact that you are improvising doesn't make it jazz. The fact that you are improvising, what makes it jazz or not is the vocabulary you're using. And if I want to be really inside of the style, I might improvise inside of the style.
Let's listen to another piece. This is La Jumba.
La Jumba is one of the non-original pieces in the album. There are just two of them. And this is my own version of it. But La Jumba is a piece by Osvaldo Pugliese, which was one of the masters of this music. And Jumba, it's a sound produced by the rhythm. It's the bass does a specific thing in the string, and then there's a hit. So the result is a sound which is zoom ba, zoom ba.
Oh, so the ba, is he hitting?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, they hit either the body of the bass, or they do something different with the bow. It's actually a specific rhythm.
Sing it again.
Zoom ba, zoom ba.
The tango masters view this. I mean, again, it's such a specific art form and a very hierarchical, you know, the people who compete and dance. How do they view, your saxophone, your improvised saxophone?
They really understand what's going on. I mean, it's a new sound, but all of them get the fact that I really studied the style. It's not something that came out of the blue and I said, okay, well, what can I do today? I'm going to play tango, period. No, I studied this style the same way I studied jazz, and even with more responsibility, because that's the music from my country. Of course, it's a new sound for them, but once they hear the music, they understand it's basically tango music. I always go to the really big names for opinions and for feedback.
Bernardo Monk, a saxophonist who was shaped by Michael Brecker and Coltrane and Charlie Parker and all the others, you know, while growing up in Argentina, and he's now leader of Mass Tango. His new CD is called Ponele la Firma. And Bernardo, thanks so much for talking to us about your music.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It was a pleasure to be here.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us.